This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
This is part two of our conversation with Michael Gray on chapter four of Song and Dance Man, Language and Tradition. The chapter is called Dylan's Use of Language Towards Complexity. In the first episode, we talked about the transformations in Bob Dylan's songwriting throughout his first four albums and ended with Spanish Harlem Incident, a song Gray called significant in Bob's move towards more complex language. Today, we continue to the heart of that complexity, discussing the songs on Highway 61 Revisited, including Like a Rolling Stone and Desolation Row, and a number of songs from Blonde on Blonde, including Stuck Inside of Mobile and Visions of Johanna, plus others. Our special guest reader again is Anne Margaret Daniel, goes by Venetian Blonde online. She's a writer and professor known for her work on Bob Dylan and F. Scott Fitzgerald. There's a link to her website in the show notes. Now, here's part two of our discussion with Michael Gray. So after Spanish Harlem, we move on to Bringing It All Back Home, and we're still in this short time period that seems long in response to us now. And Bringing It All Back Home, you know, we find Mr. Tambourine Man with the, you know, maybe the most cited skipping reels of rhyme clause that everyone talks about. And you talk about It's All Right, Ma as merging an old approach with new language. And that's an album that ends with the famous It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
And, you know, we were still getting used to, well, I was still getting used to how lengthy a Bob Dylan song could be. And that one's comparatively short. Like Too Late, it has that let the dead bury the dead thing in it towards the end. Forget the dead you've left, they will not bother you. So we're already back in the language of the Bible, the New Testament even.
So in the book, there's a passage just after It's All Right, Ma, where you make an interesting observation about some of these changes are a different change than the main linguistic complexity we're talking about. So let's listen to that quote.
All these changes seem to stem from Dylan discarding an anger that was the child of optimism and indignation, as, for instance, in Masters of War, that could only be sustained so long as the belief in enlightened congressmen about to heed the call could itself be sustained. Dylan's graduation from the Masters of War approach toward real poetry, the poetry of real experience, can in this way be seen as prompted not by a change in political belief, nor by a rejection of politics, which is the same thing, but by a change in assessment of his political vision. To put it over simply, Dylan became a more serious artist when profound political pessimism set in.
I'd still agree with that. I think, you know, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. I mean, that might be pleasant retrospectively when we see him singing it to Obama, but that's not its main function. And its main function is expressing a naivety that he is losing by the time of Bringing It All Back Home. And he's also disillusioned with his own protesting, with his own anger. And It's All Right, Ma, I mean, sometimes there's a sort of suggestion of acceptance of things. It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding, you know, I'm not dead. But at other times, you know, he's condemning himself as one who sings with his tongue on fire, gargled in the rat race choir. I love that phrase, one who sings with his tongue on fire. And that again, you know, that could be straight from the Bible, and it may be, you know, because after all, when we look back at all this stuff, right from Blowing in the Wind, he brings the Bible into that too. How many ears must one man have? How many eyes must one man have These are both straight from the Gospels. Anyway, so what I'm saying by the time of It's All Right, Ma, and certainly by the time of what we come on to when we start to look at Highway 61 Revisited, is an embarrassment, perhaps, at the naivety of calling for senators and congressmen to please heed the call, whereas Dr. Filth, as I've said somewhere else, Dr. Filth is still around. You know, that sort of language, which was called surrealistic, Dr. Filth, he keeps his patients inside of a leather cup. That's still political, you know. Dr. Filth is a more hard-headed political designation than please heed the call could ever be, you know, or feeling that it would be possible to dance on the grave of specific guilty people who were masters of war, you know. The other thing, though, I want to say in the context of this stuff is that the 1960s, we're in the middle of the 1960s here, and they were a period in which pessimism and optimism came cheek by jowl. They came together. I mean, first of all, there was, the liberation, the optimism of a boom economy and a freedom from the terrible constraints of the 1950s, economic restraints, social restraints, personal political restraints, particularly for women. And so the 60s, we're in a boom economy, even in Britain, not just the States. And things are looking great, you know. And by 1965, a pivotal year, the 60s are exploding. But at the same time, that explosion also gives you a new realism about the awfulness of American politics, a new recognition and realization of the way that they set up coups and ousted governments all over the Western Hemisphere, all that, you know. And towards the end of the 60s, we get the politics of the real extraordinary, now it seems extraordinary, the radicalism of young Americans who were starting to, you know, bomb things and be fired upon in turn by troops. So it was a very weird mix of optimism and pessimism. And I think that that's reflected in what Dylan was writing at that period.
It's interesting to demark, which you do in the book, It's All Right, Ma, as kind of the last protest song. As we look at this in retrospect, right, there's three albums, maybe in 2 years, that's the protest period, which obviously out of 60 is a small percentage compared to how it dominates, you know, the image or the way people think about him. Conversely, this pessimism, if you will, or lack of optimism, has kind of sustained the last 54 years since then, with few exceptions. And certainly Dylan's, you know, kind of political pronouncements, he no longer, other than showing up at We Are the World, maybe thinks a song is going to fix anything.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, he withdraws from explicit political comment, if you like, and so do a lot of other people. A lot of people got their heads bashed in, you know. There's a really interesting book by the guy who was Allen Ginsberg's farm manager, a guy whose name slips my mind just at the moment, but who was one of those people. He was a lecturer at West Point, and he was one of those who was entitled to nominate Dylan for the Nobel Prize every year. And he did, year after year after year. But anyway, his book about the farm that Allen Ginsberg had up in New York State, the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. One of the things that's really great about that book, apart from bringing out what a really kind and generous and restrained person Ginsberg was, in the face of a lot of, you know, assholes turning up and staying and doing nothing, none of the work. But the other thing is how virulent the divide was between crew-cut America and long-hair America at that point. It's a brief period, you know, and maybe it ends after the Soledad brothers, when Black Power starts to sort of calm down. It's a period in which New York society invites Black Power leaders to its cocktail parties, and Bob Dylan stays silent.
The protest period, what was in it, what wasn't in it, what happened later is one of these Dylan topics that can go endlessly.
It does continue to resonate, doesn't it? As you say, it's a very short period, but it's a period that he's still associated with because he was changing everything then. And it's also a period which has its own longevity, you know. People still appreciate songs like Masters of War.
One of these many Dylan things that he did for a little while, but did so well and so much better than everyone else,
yes,
that even he remains the best example, even though he stopped, you know, after 30 months or something.
Sure.
But let's move forward, because as you say, as Highway 61, you know, begins and the now famous snare shot heard around the world, yeah, starts, we do get a different kind of writing, or we at least progress more fully into it, which is the subject of this chapter. So let's talk about Like a Rolling Stone.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you
know, you discuss in the book how it showcases a change from personal to universal. Another observation that's just very interesting in making sense of Dylan. You attribute to a calculated lack of specificity. So before we discuss this, let's listen to an excerpt about Like a Rolling Stone.
But if this use of language, which is still in transition in Like a Rolling Stone, no longer offers us autobiography, its universal glimpses are of course rendered as through Dylan's eyes. And so, like any great artist, Dylan bequeaths us a part of reality we could not otherwise have received. To render things that are real in a genuinely new way, which takes more than an original style, is actually to have created something new and at the same time true.
Yeah, I think this brings us back to what T.S. Eliot achieved a generation earlier. And all I really want to say about this is, everyone can take what they will from Like a Rolling Stone, but this thing about style and content, you know, what I say there about it takes more than an original style, that's a kind of, that's a slight, you know, that's in brackets. That's very much in brackets. But what I want to say about that is something which the renegade British literary critic F.R. Leavis said, which was, style is inseparable from content. That is, if you say something one way, it's not the same thing you're saying as if you say it a different way. And this is a great literary truth, and if you will, a great truth about records, you know? And this is why, a very easy demonstration of this is to listen to any American hit single from the from let's say 1960 or 62, and then listen to the pathetic British cover version of that same song, which they did all the time because the BBC didn't like to play American records. They liked to play British records. So there was just this whole thing in those days of cover versions all the time, you know. The difference between the one and the other is not a difference of style. It becomes a difference of content, you know. And part of what's unique about Like a Rolling Stone is the whole cacophonous whole of it, which no one else could possibly have created. And even if you'd said the same words in a different way, you'd have been saying something else.
We now know, because we've listened to the 15 takes or something.
Yeah.
But it seems like if take 7 would have been released, it kind of would not have been like Rolling Stone, that take
exactly
got it.
Exactly. Yeah. One of them, they try it in 3-4 time, don't they? At one point, like a waltz.
First, that's the first take, which was on one of the even earlier bootlegs, maybe on Biograph even.
Yeah. I think it might have been on that Highway 61 interactive CD-ROM that came out in whenever CD-ROMs were groovy.
It's on a shelf right over there, yes. I remember sitting holding it when it was brand new and clicking through the screens and all the... There's a YouTube video where someone's captured all the screens and you can watch a video of it now, so you don't have to try to rig up a 1980s PC.
Right.
Yeah, I've actually been thinking about this issue of songs, exactly your point you just made about the difference in... You know, we often say we hear a song and we say it's a bad song or whatever the words are, and that's a whole issue. But you hear an early version, and I have more Costello examples in mind, where it was slow, acoustic, you know, the one he wrote. And then the performance is, you know, one of those early 80s hyper. And it's, you know, the song didn't change. He just found a better way to present it. And it didn't become a good song. You know, did it become a good song, or was it a good song that wasn't being presented right? It's considered a good song because of the way it's presented. Maybe we beat that. But at the other end of the same album, and sticking with the theme of language of complexity, one that you cite often, Desolation Row comes up.
The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand tied to the tightrope walker, the other is in his pants.
And so I pulled three paragraphs from a much longer discussion, and I'll get more to this in a minute. We're discussing here, this is an incredible chapter. In the second half, you go song by song by song, and there's pages of just really incredible analysis that I really think everyone who loves these songs will really enjoy. Let's listen to these three paragraphs about Desolation Row.
This change seems complete by the time of Desolation Row, a classic illustration of the distinction between accusation and analysis. Desolation Row is a brilliant political analysis of American society and shows vividly the connection between its pessimism and a seriousness of intent. In Desolation Row, the imminent disasters are past and present as well as future. The verses pile up and pile up, the sinister intimations pile up with them, and there is no suggestion, no hope, in other words, that the crescendo will ever be curtailed. Dylan no longer expects solutions to arise out of reforms or legislation. Neither does he see any point in rallying around the home comforts of "We Shall Overcome." There is no broad solution.
The pollution of human values is here. It's a grand phrase, but I think that is his concern. And that's why at the end he says, "Don't send me no more letters, no, not unless you write them from Desolation Row." In other words, you know, don't give me any more of this stuff. Just get real. It's a lot of people's favorite song. I feel as if for myself, I'm a bit sort of over familiar with it, but that's my problem, you know. But the intimations of bad things happening, you know, the fortune telling lady has even taken all her things inside, you know, there's just such great expressions of that all the way through the song. And of course, what we come to very near the end in a verse that, as we've said before, regrettably he doesn't sing anymore, usually. The Titanic sails at dawn. You know, this is a very economical phrase for saying doom is imminent.
That's great. I think as much as people love it, maybe for this build up that you just
and a beautiful acoustic guitar work.
Yeah, I was going to say, just I think as much as people love the effect of it, I don't think, well, for me, and I think a lot of people, it's very hard to understand. I mean, even these kind of commentary, you know, this is a good example of kind of opening it up, because that the fortune telling lady takes all her things inside. I've heard right 700 million times. This idea that, you know, even the professionally hopeful are losing faith is not a recognition that I had made before. So this is great. In the book, you go through, can you please crawl out your window? Farewell, Angelina. Absolutely sweet Marie. Fourth time around. There was so many, it was hard to narrow down which ones.
I was surprised when I reread it to see how much I liked, can you please crawl out your window? I mean, I do, but you know, I think I overrated in the book.
And Farewell Angelina is one that's nice to get coverage on, because it's, you know, still generally an obscure song.
A very weird recording in his 1960s pantheon. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound as if it ought to have been on any of the album.
And it wasn't. To Let Time March On, we'll move to Blonde on Blonde and cover a little bit, because that may be where this chapter ends. And like a conversation for Blonde on Blonde, as you did on our podcast for Time Out of Mind, you named the four major works. And I thought we would talk about them. So here's the first.
The greatness of One of Us Must Know is to do with vague but dramatic impressions it carries in its music and overall structure. It is manifestly, magnificently alive, like some once-in-a-lifetime party, and aptly the lyric impinges as if it's being delivered at a party, the voice rising and falling against a backdrop of bubbling noises and motion. The music flows over you in waves, so that linked to the party impression, the song suggests itself fleetingly as a rock equivalent of the party Scott Fitzgerald creates in The Great Gatsby. One of Us Must Know is like that. Not in its people or its social orientation, but as regards its rhythms, its movement, its life. It breathes with a kind of majestic sexuality. It holds your attention with a symphonic sort of warmth. The music never stops rising and falling to complement this. Ordinary small words, signifying little on their own, are caressed into a loving but subservient eloquence by Dylan's voice.
I'd like to say, without sounding too pleased with myself, that's an example towards the end of that, of what I can do with words when I'm writing about Bob Dylan's words and voice.
Yeah.
And really, that's all I want to say about that song at this point. Yeah. But, you know, in general, the chapter is Dylan's use of language towards complexity. And certainly, Blonde on Blonde, in most ways, gave every impression of continuing that movement into a more complex language than certainly the early work. I do remember, though, when I first heard it, which was in New York City. I was in New York in 1966 for the first time. I was staying in an apartment on the edge of where Broadway meets the beginning of Harlem, and it was fantastic to be there then. 106 degrees on Fifth Avenue in August at the time, and I saw Blonde on Blonde in a shop window and bought it. And when I first played it, in this apartment that I was allowed to stay in, a lot of it seemed quite simple. A lot of it seemed more like pop music than he had ever done before. There's a lot more sort of songs about baby and love and stuff, you know. But that's just the sort of adjustment that you have to make from one Dylan album to another, especially back then. And that's not at all to deny the complexity of language that he throws at us on this album. It just seemed, partly because it was just so hip, you know. Part of the hipness we know retrospectively comes from the fact that it's an album completely saturated in the blues. But at the time, it just seemed like nothing else that had ever existed. It brought up, among other things, and this is partly my disquiet about its popness, perhaps, to start with. One of the things it does is it challenges what people still thought of as a great divide between high culture and popular culture. You know, when a song like Visions of Johanna starts saying, the one with the mustache said, "Geez, I can't find my knees," you know. I remember seeing that live in Liverpool in 66, and people were going, "Is this still all right?" You know, and that's because we had all been, despite being so hip, we had all been, you know, inculcated with this idea that that you were supposed to either be on the side of, you know, Beethoven and Goethe and Jane Austen, or on the side of Marvel Comics and, you know, I don't know, Bob B. Socks and the Blue Jeans. And Bob Dylan really challenged that. He knew better than that. But I think in knowing better than that, he owed a lot to the Beat Poets, because they had been doing that earlier.
So the second song on your list of four is Memphis Blues Again. So let's listen to two short paragraphs about that.
Beyond being an exciting rock music performance, Memphis Blues Again is at least as great as One of Us Must Know. The narrator is someone just trying to get by in modern America. Someone trying to get by, that is, without shutting off or closing up. Someone who sees a lot happening around him, but can't discern any pattern to it, nor any constant but meaninglessness. Someone who, in this situation, stays more outwardly vulnerable than he needs to because he retains a yearning, however vague, for some better kind of world.
Well, Shakespeare, he's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bells, speaking to some French girl who says she knows me well. And I would send a message to find out if she's taught, but the post office has been stolen and the mailbox is locked.
I mean, that's what... Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck in Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again. You know, although every verse describes the meaninglessness of what he experiences, he manages to describe himself as a sort of very benign, well-meaning, innocent, who struggles to understand any of this chaos around him, but wishes that he could. But then towards the end, because Bob Dylan is, you know, hipper than that, he grows weary of this. And so he ends with, "Oh, mama, can this really be the end, to be stuck inside of Mobile with the..." You know, the bit about having to go all these things twice. The bit about having to go all through these things twice. That's the last defeated, heartfelt plea. Surely there's something better than this. Surely I don't have to just wade through this chaos from here on in. Get me out of here. There must be a better world out there.
It's interesting that
several of these we've talked about, but certainly everything you just said is the coming to grips with the loss of the optimism. Thinking, okay, yes. Now here I am. I'm not optimistic, and now I have to deal with the fact that when I really look around, these are the things I see.
Yeah.
The next major work you just mentioned, here's a passage on Visions of Johanna.
The mixture of serious and flippant language, the mixture of delicacy and coarseness, the mixture of abstract neo-philosophy and figurative phraseology, the ambiguity that begins with the song's very title, because Johanna is not just a woman's name, but also the Hebrew for Armageddon. The humor, the intensive buildup of the song's scope, all this is pressed into the service of a work of art at once indefinable and precise. It is, not for the first time, hard to say what the song is about, and yet it impresses as saying a good deal, and in doing so it engages a great many of Dylan's distinctive strengths.
That's a good paragraph, Michael.
Thank you. It's a beautiful thing, though, isn't it? I mean, it begins so beautifully in this hot room in New York City. And
they've kind of timed a blackout to the writing, which just puts another thought in your head there that, you know, wouldn't have had.
Uh-huh. What I remember particularly is hearing that live in Liverpool in 66, because as I've said before, it wasn't only completely new to the audiences then. It was like no other song they'd ever heard, you know. Many, many verses, 14 lines per verse, and just dealing with everything. You know, the all-night watchman, the girls, the D train, everything. And then just lines of great poetry, like the stuff about the light bulb and the electricity and the harmonicas and the head of the mule. It's just fabulous. Yeah.
You also say that the click that Dylan provides him with is precisely the kind of tiny detail that is large part of Dickens' touch. Dylan gives us the same cartoon precision, deftly sketching in the night watchman's mannered essentials.
Yes. I mean, that's probably something I've never noticed again in all these decades. But it is true that the click of the night watchman's torch is a lovely small touch. And I do think that's Dickensian. One of the great things about Dickens is that sort of detail. I don't suggest that Dylan has ever particularly paid Dickens much attention. I have no idea, but I would like to suggest that most people should, and certainly they should certainly relish and take their time with and absorb Bleak House, if no other.
I think they're all songs that people, you know, hear more than they understand, and then these little glimpses of meaning, yes, or connection help a lot.
Absolutely, yes. Oh, well, good. Yeah, Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. Go on then, read that bit if you'd like to.
To turn from Visions of Johanna to Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands is not only, as earlier implied, to turn from one major song on Blonde to another, it is also to turn from a success to a failure, and a failure no more explicable than most things to do with Dylan's work. It's long, it's attractive, it's puzzling, it's ambiguous, and Dylan's voice on it is very beautiful. But it isn't one of Dylan's great songs. All the same, the intention behind the song was clearly a major one, and the recording is prominent enough to merit a special attention. It is also directly after Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, in the chronology of his released recordings, that Dylan draws back from this ever-thickening undergrowth of surreal, elusively complex use of language. After it, he begins, in general, the harder process of paring down toward a new simplicity.
you read the main text there, but you didn't read the footnote. And this is my only response to that quote from me is to read out the footnote that I stuck on the end of that, because that passage was written 50 years ago.
Yeah.
The passage you've just read out. And then this footnote was written a mere 30 years ago. Okay. And it says, when I read this assessment now, I simply feel embarrassed at what a little snob I was when I wrote it. In contrast, and paradoxically, when I go back and listen after a long gap to Dylan's recording, every ardent, true feeling I ever had comes back to me. Decades of detritus drop away, and I feel back in communion with my best self and soul. Whatever the shortcomings of the lyric, the recording itself, capturing at its absolute peak Dylan's incomparable capacity for intensity of communication, is a masterpiece if ever there was one. It isn't like listening to a record. It enfolds you, to use a word from the song itself, in a whole universe. Amen.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, I've a number of times felt bad in retrospect that we didn't find a way to make the footnotes both larger and more in context. It was just a logistical thing in the book, because the book would have gone to, you know, back to 500 pages. But I do want to encourage readers of the new or old edition to dive into those footnotes, as Michael just showed. There's great rewards there. As you've said before, that whole you arguing with yourself is an interesting literary technique.
If I might mention it, there's a much more recent piece of work of mine about Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands in my 2020 book, Outtakes.
Yeah, well, so that brings us through, I mean, just barely touching on it here, but a major chapter of the book. We're obviously headed to some more major chapters ahead, but as we've been doing in this series of chats, is looking at the transitions and flows of what Dylan's been doing, is that it's after Blonde on Blonde that he pulls back, a significant change in the kind of writing and words that he uses, because even in Dylan's world, the old stuff never stops, because it's still brought out in concert and played, and that creates this mixture that makes it hard for us to separate this stuff. We're about to go from Blonde on Blonde to John Wesley Harding and Nashville Skyline and Self Portrait, in a very different kind of language, at least from his pen.
Yes, we are. And that thing about the gap, there's a time gap as well, isn't there? Because, 1964, he releases two albums, The Times They Are Changing and Another Side Of. 1965, he releases Bringing It All Back Home and Highway 61 Revisited. 66, he releases Blonde on Blonde. And then an extraordinarily long gap by the standards of the industry. John Wesley Harding technically released on December the 27th, 1967, but to all intents and purposes, a 1968 release. 2 years, I mean, two actual years. That determination to not do a follow-up has served him pretty well down the decades, one way and another.
It's a great chapter for everyone to spend a lot of time in. Anyway, thank you, Michael, for going through it.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.